From the National Endowment for the Arts, this is Artworks. I'm Josephine Reed. Last week, we lost two giants of music. 1995 NEA jazz master, drummer, Roy Haynes, who died at the age of 99, and 2013 NEA jazz master, saxophonist, Lou Donaldson, who passed away at the age of 98. And obviously, we're saddened by their losses, but we also want to celebrate their lives. And we're fortunate enough to have interviews with them both, which we're excerpting here in tribute to their extraordinary musicianship. Let's start with Roy Haynes and Green Chimneys, composed by Thelonious Monk and performed by the Roy Haynes Trio. Roy Haynes defined the word style in every sense, from his distinctive drumming to his snappy clothes. He was first among equals. Known for his unique, crisp drumming, Haynes may have been the most recorded drummer in jazz. In a career lasting more than 70 years, he played in a wide range of styles, ranging from swing and bebop to jazz fusion and avant-garde jazz. He had been equally successful as a leader and as a sideman. Thelonious Monk described Haynes' drumming as, quote, an eight ball right in the side pocket. Haynes collaborated with the who's who in the jazz world. As well as Monk, there was Charlie Parker, Lester Young, Miles Davis, Danilo Perez, and Christian McBride. And I'm only naming a very, very few. Roy Haynes also had a reputation as a tough interview, but he had a surprising amount of patience when he sat down with me at Jazz at Lincoln Center in 2014. Here's an excerpt of our talk. You got your start with Lewis Russell.
Mm-hmm.
How did that happen?
It happened by what I was doing and the way I was doing what I was doing. People talked about that because Lewis Russell didn't know anything about Roy Haynes. Until people told him, and then I was living in Boston at the time. I got a special delivery letter from New York from Lewis Russell. He had never heard me, but he heard about me. And I guess it's probably the people that told him about me, for him to stretch out and try to reach me, which is the way it happened.
One of the first gigs you played with him was at the Savoy.
The first gig was at the Savoy.
It was the very first. Yes. What was that like? Savoy like then?
The Savoy, you can't hardly describe it in anything that you'll know about. Yeah. You got to have a great imagination. Because a lot of people would come to the Savoy ballroom and they probably wouldn't even dance. There's so much excitement going on. First of all, they had two bandstands. They usually had a big band on one bandstand and a small band, a combo, and the next bandstand. Back in probably late 30s, early 40s, they would have the battle of the bands. So the two bands, they did be battling. I used to hear a lot about it when I was young in Boston, because I think certain nights they would broadcast anyhow from the Savoy Ballroom in Harlem to different stations. So I had heard about it. And when I first played there with Lewis Russell's band, I don't think the bands were really battling then, because it'd be a big band on one side, 12, 13, 14 piece, and a small combo on the other side, the other part of the bandstand, which was like twin bandstands together. But that was really an exciting period, because not only the people came to dance, some people would just stand in front of the bandstand and listen. They call that the home of the happy feet. Because a lot of people could dance like they were professional in those days. The 40s was when I first come to New York with the band. And my first job, like I was saying, was at the Savoy Ballroom in Harlem. So it was a very exciting period.
as you said, Louis Russell, of course, had a big band.
Yeah, we had, 12 or 13-piece orchestra, you know, three brass, maybe three trumpets, three trombones, three saxophones, three or four saxophones, and a guitar, bass, and drums, and a great vocalist.
Who was the vocalist?
Lee Richardson, when I was with the band. He made hit records. One of his big records was The Very Thought of You. He had this voice, The Very Thought of You, and I Forget to Do. You know, and all the young girls would be screaming. You know, we play theaters like the Earl Theater in Philadelphia, and we do five shows a day during that period, you know.
Five shows a day?
Oh, yes. And if they had a lot of people waiting in lines after each show, they would have to add another show to it. So, you know, you got a chance to make extra money then. You know, the more shows you did, the more money you made. And a lot of that wasn't always planned in advance. Sometimes it would just happen when it would happen, you know, the last minute. People would be lined up to come in the theater waiting for people to leave so they could come in and catch the show.
How important do you think that experience was for you as a performer, especially playing in a big band?
Well, it was my first big band experience, for one thing, which is something I wanted to do anyhow, because I used to listen to a lot of the big bands, like the Basie Band, when he had Papa Joe Jones playing drums. And also when he left, they had other younger drummers, you know, that I would go and catch, you know, with the band. In fact, I did get a chance to play with that band a couple of times when I was much younger also. But I was never a steady drummer with the band. I just filled in, you know, for a few nights.
And Papa Joe Jones is one of the drummers that you listen to.
Oh, definitely. He was the main one. In fact, you know, a lot of drummers my age, you know, during that time, drummers of any age usually were checking out Papa Joe Jones.
What was it about his sound?
Not only his sound, his feeling, the way he would do different things. It's hard to explain because I'm talking about early 40s. You know, I'm just beginning to be a professional drummer, and I'm listening to certain things that other drummers didn't do, and the way he would do what he did, the feeling came from here. It wasn't nobody just practice. You know, this was a natural drummer, which is what they told me I was. I was just born natural drummer, so I could sort of relate to Papa Joe.
You saw the birth of bebop. Did it grab you right away when you first heard it? Was it like an explosion in your mind when you first heard it?
I don't know if I would look at it as an explosion, but it was something new that was happening. The tunes, like the compositions, and the way the different artists were playing, certain artists, you know, the things that they were doing musically. Yeah, it was something new. So it did grab me, yeah. I jumped right on it, yeah.
And you played with Charlie Parker.
Yes, Charlie Parker hired me. I forget what year it was, 1949, I'm thinking, yeah. And I was with Lester Young during that period. And I know once there was a concert in, I think, Baltimore, Maryland, where there were two bands, Charlie Parker's band. I was with Lester Young then. And Charlie Parker was there with his band, and his drummer at that time was Max Roach. So Max Roach's drums were set up on the bandstand, and I said, I'm going to sit my drums right beside his. You know, Max was very popular then, and I was a younger guy, a couple of years younger than him, just beginning to get popular also. So I said, yes, I'm going to set my drums right up next to his, and I did. And not even realizing that I would end up playing with Charlie Parker. I was with Lester Young then. And that was a great time of my life with the music and a great experience to be playing with Lester Young opposite Charlie Parker.
I would think it would be.
Oh, yes. That was a very exciting period.
I seem to remember people saying Lester Young spoke in a very particular language. He was very funny, but you kind of had to understand where he was coming from to get what he was saying. Did you find that to be the case?
Yeah, that's very true. Lester Young, he was one of the most, how can I describe him so people understand? Original people that I've ever met, not only the way he dressed, the way he talked. He would talk, if he had just met you, he would talk his language to you. So some of the things you probably wouldn't understand what he was saying, but that's the way he was. He was a very original person all the way. The way he played, the way he dressed, and the way he talked. And it was not just a put-on thing. It was, that's the way this man was.
Were you sorry to leave that band and go with Charlie Parker in some ways?
I was happy because I wasn't just moving on to move on. I was going to be playing with Charlie Parker, one of the great persons. You know, I went from Charlie Parker to Sarah Vaughan.
Right.
You know, it was great playing with Charlie Parker. He's a great genius. Sarah Vaughan was a genius also. They did a recording together that also inspired me. Charlie Parker was on a recording with Sarah Vaughan. Sarah Vaughan, I mean, she could just, she knew the music too. She knew the chords, the changes that she wanted the musicians, especially the keyboard player, to play for her. You know, we have a lot of people that are great singers, you know, but they don't always know the music or about what they're doing. They just do it naturally only, and they're gifted to do it that way. But Sarah Vaughan, you know, she could pick up the music and read the music as well, a new composition that she never heard before. One of the differences of just playing with somebody who can sing and, you know, not a great musician, but Sarah Vaughan was a great musician as well.
You were with Thelonious Monk at the Five Spot with a great live recording. I think it was
late 50s or 60s.
Yeah. What was it like playing with Monk?
It was great. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed every moment. Monk wasn't just an ordinary artist. You know, he had a lot of feeling, a lot of imagination, and it was great. It was great playing with him. Only thing that was kind of strange, sometimes you had to wait hours before he would show up. So we wouldn't play till he arrived. So sometimes the club would be crowded with people waiting for Monk to come, you know. But that was a long time ago. That was in the late 50s. That was yesterday.
That was yesterday. Jazz has a reputation, rightly or wrongly, of being not a young person's music anymore. I'm often in audiences, and I always look around to try to see how old people are in the audiences, and they tend to be older audiences. And opening jazz up to younger people seems to me to be something that is a very significant thing to do, and that is something that you do. Your audiences, the demographics tend to be more skewed. I'm not saying they're all young any means, but they do tend to be more skewed.
You're absolutely right. That's something, huh?
Something for me
to think about, too. You know, I think about, you know, because sometimes I don't notice it right away. I've heard people say years ago, I'm not talking about the last 2 years, but even before that, you draw a really young audience. People years ago would say that about me, you know, when I was much younger than I am, you know. So I guess that has to do with the music or the recordings or something they heard or read about. I don't analyze things. I don't try to. A lot of the things that happen, I just keep on keeping on and don't try to figure them out. That's what I do on the bandstand, too, a lot of times. If I try to really figure out the music, boom, 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 I try to do it by what I feel rather than talk about it. Even if I have somebody new in my band, I don't sit down and tell them what I expect them to do, what I would like them to do. Usually they probably feel something or heard from somewhere. Or we don't talk about it much. And it works. It has been working. I'm going to leave it alone.
Thank you for coming in.
Oh, yeah.
I appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
It's been very nice to,
yeah, that feels good.
To talk to
yeah, you.
Yeah, you
say that.
And if anybody does Green Chimneys better than you, I have yet to hear it. It is just unbelievable.
It sounds good.
That was an excerpt of a 2014 interview with 1995 NEA jazz master Roy Haynes, who died last week at the age of 99. He's quite simply one of the best drummers who's ever played. We're taking a quick break, and we'll return with our tribute to the late NEA jazz master Lou Donaldson. Welcome back. I'm Josephine Reed, and this is Artworks. And now our remembrance of 2013 NEA Jazz Master Lou Donaldson, who passed away last week at the age of 98. Lou Donaldson's alto sax had been a force in jazz for more than six decades. He spent his early years in the bebop era, influenced heavily by Charlie Parker. But Donaldson combined bop with a more soulful sound that was absolutely his own. It was a style of playing that earned him the nickname Sweet Papa Lou. Donaldson made a series of classic records for Blue Note in the 1950s, and his first records with organist Jimmy Smith led to the groove-filled jazz of the 1960s and 70s. Lou Donaldson was an outstanding stage presence and continued to perform his swinging bebop until he was 92 years old when he announced his retirement. I spoke with him in late 2012 when he was named an NEA Jazz Master. Here are some excerpts of that interview.
First time I heard jazz was on a radio station, WBT, from Charlotte, North Carolina, which was a country and western station. That's all they played. But they had one disc jockey there, a guy named Grady Cole, never will forget him, and he had one record, Louis Armstrong. It was St. James Infirmary, and he played that every day because he loved that. And that's my first time listening to hearing jazz music, and I liked it. In fact, I waited for that one record.
And Lou Donaldson is clear about what influenced his own sound on the saxophone.
Whenever I play a ballad, I always try to get a tone like Johnny Hodges. Like he used to slur notes and sustain certain notes on his saxophone. And when I tried to move through the chords, I would try to move through them like Charlie Parker. Because I like Charlie Parker's sound. I heard him playing with Jay McShann's band, and it was great. I'd never heard anything like that before. He changed my approach completely. Because I wanted to play like that. So that's about the style I played. And I'd buy the records and wear them down to the aluminum. You know, they had aluminum bass then, and I'd play them so much I'd wear out the record.
Lou Donaldson moved to New York City in 1950, a great place for jazz. He became the house saxophonist at the legendary Mittens Playhouse, one of the birthplaces of bebop.
We had about 10 clubs right in Harlem where you could go and play, you know, music. Mittens was like a joint. It wasn't really a club. And it was what we call a walk-in place. You know, you didn't have to pay anything. And everybody came there. It was like a celebrity hangout because you had people, say, like Roy Eldridge and Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, Sarah Vaughan. They worked downtown. But their jobs ended at 12 o'clock or 1 o'clock. Mittens stayed open till 4 o'clock. So about 2 o'clock, all of them were there. Used to come in to hear the music. So it was great. Best club to play in. Never be another place like that.
Lou came on the scene pretty much at the beginning of bebop, and he's thought and wrote about that transition from swing to bop.
See, most of the jazz before bebop was dance music. All the bands played for dancing. Every band played for dancing. Very few bands ever played like concerts. Maybe Duke Ellington or somebody like that once in a while. But everybody has Count Basie, Jimmy Lunchfoot, you know, all the bands. They played for dancing. That's what they were, dance bands. The transition was that Dizzy and Charlie Parker had a new way of playing music, and it was a smaller group. Small group, wasn't big band when it first came out. Actually, what happened is he talked Coleman Hawkins into making a record called Woody and You. It was written for Woody Herman. And that set everybody on that trend and started them playing that way. And it was a smaller group, and they played a lot of solos. See, in the dance bands, you didn't have many solos. Maybe had one or two, and that was it. And you never had a drum solo but once a night. They used the featured drummer one time a night, and that was it. No more. And it was great. But bebop, you could play, everybody could play on every song, and it's a different kind of setup.
Lou Donaldson was one of the people, along with Art Blakey and Clifford Brown, who performed on one of the great live jazz albums, A Night in Birdland.
One, two, three.
It's the best recorded session ever done live. Yeah. It was Blue Note Day. Blue Note, Alfred Lion got everybody together and wanted us to make this date. What happened is that he put Art on the drums, and Horace and myself. And I had made this record with Clifford Brown a year before then. And they liked Clifford Brown so well, they brought Clifford Brown in on trumpet. And Curly Russell on bass, and that's the way it developed. The people were into the music, and Clifford Brown was so dynamic, you wouldn't believe. I would have played the job for no money. This cat was great. To be so young and to have so much stuff together at that age, it was amazing. It was amazing. And Art actually played well on that self, so it was amazing. Amazing. You got the energy, the projection from the music to the people. And you can hear it on the record. And it was great. It was great. It's a different kind of music. As anybody knows that play music, sometimes you just into it better. You play better. Same songs every night, but it's a different thing. Some nights, a different thing.
Blues Walk in 1958 became your signature song.
Oh, yeah, that's my theme song.
How did it come about? Talk about that.
Well, you won't believe it. I had a meeting with Al Lyon and Frank Wolfe, and I told them, I said, look, I'm not recording any more music with any junkies. Junkies got to go. I'm going to pick the musicians, I'm going to pick the band, and we're going to make this record. So I picked this guy, Herman Foster, who played piano. He was blind. He was singing in the church, but I had been playing jam sessions with him up at Connie's, and I liked him. And I picked Dave Bailey, drummer. Dave was a liquor salesman, but I had played some stuff with him, and I liked him. And I got Ray Barreto on the conga. And the bass player I had was Peck Morrison, who lived with me. I was living in the housing project at that time. Up in Throg's Neck in the Bronx. And he got in, and he was my neighbor, so he played the bass. And we made this record, and it was a hit. I couldn't believe it. Frank Wolfe told me, it's the first record that Blue Note got on the jukebox from New York to California. That's a good tune. It's got a good groove to it.
You know, you're known for being able to read an audience.
Right. Yeah, well, we had what we call a feel-em-out set, the first set.
Feel-em-out?
Feel-em-out. When we went to a new place that we'd never played, we played a cross section of music. We played fast, we played slow, we played blues, we played ballads. Whatever the people responded to, that's where we laid, and we got them. Then we sneak in a couple of bebop tunes and anything that we wanted to play. But once we got them in our pocket, that's what we did. It's amazing. But music is like that, you know.
His other great jazz innovation was a series of recordings with Jimmy Smith that popularized the organ sax trio sound.
That was it. Jimmy was a genius. Jimmy was a good piano player, too. But Jimmy was a guy that found that organ and found a new way of playing the organ, like you could play a piano. Up until then, organ players, they didn't really play like piano players. You listen to Milt Buckner, Wild Bill Davis, and all those kind of people. They played organ a different way. But Jimmy played it like a piano. It looked like he was Art Tatum playing an organ. And he was great. and my sound, we were very compatible. Yeah, we worked together without a doubt. We had two or three straight hit records, you know, just like that. It's great.
Lou also had a big hit with his song Alligator Boogaloo, this time with NEA jazz master Dr. Lonnie Smith on the organ. Even this short excerpt will explain why. Donaldson also played with singers, including a stint he did with Betty Carter at the Audubon in New York, which came together in a very unpredictable way.
And this is a story I'm telling you. Now, this is a story that you won't believe. I was working in Washington, D.C., and I played from 5 to 8, and we had to come back to New York. We got to come through Baltimore, which is about 30 miles away, and I knew that Miles was working in Baltimore, so I said, let's go by and catch Miles' last set, Saturday night. So I get there about 9 or 10 o'clock. No Miles. I see his band, Paul Chambers, Philly Joe, Red Garland, sitting out on the stoop with their instruments. And I said, what's happening? Why are you sitting out here? They said, we're not playing, and the guy won't give us any money. And I said, what happened? Miles drew all the money up on Friday night, and they haven't seen Miles since. And naturally, they didn't have any way to get to New York. So I didn't have anything in my station wagon. So I said, all right, put the bass and drums and things in there, and I'll take you to Philadelphia, which I did. And when I got to New York, Red Garland called me and said, man, we couldn't, Miles. Said, we see you working up at the Audubon. So can we make a couple of weeks up there? I said, yeah, of course. You know, you can make it, you know, but I didn't have nothing but local musicians. So I put out this big sign, Lou Donaldson with the Red Garland Trio. So many people came, they didn't have the space. And so what had happened, I booked the place myself. I rented the place. I had rented it for the summer. And we played from 5 to 9 every Sunday evening. And the business got so good, I said, we better bring in a singer. So I brought in Betty Carter. That's how she got there. In fact, she wasn't even famous then. And it was a great group, great time.
And what happened?
Everybody made a lot of money and got famous.
And here are some of Lou's thoughts about his career.
I don't have any doubt about my plan. It's just a rewarding profession. I don't know anything else that a person could do more rewarding than being an artist.
That is the late, great 2013 NEA jazz master saxophonist Lou Donaldson. This has been our tribute to Lou and to Roy Haynes, who both passed away last week, and they are already missed. You can go to their pages at arts.gov to find out more about their lives and their music. We'll have links in our show notes. You've been listening to Artworks, produced at the National Endowment for the Arts. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a rating. It helps other people who love the arts to find us. I'm Josephine Reed. Thanks for listening.